This is La Paloma, and I'm here with Davy Jones, and today we have the pleasure of talking with...
Roger Greenewalt, also known as Roger the Record Producer.
All right, Roger, I can't do a phone interview without asking this question.
Yes.
So what are you wearing?
it's so bourgeois. I'm wearing plaid blue Vans, blue bell-bottom blue jeans, and then slanted blue striped shirt that matches the blue plaid, sort of. And I'm wearing my hair long this season.
Very good. So you're all coordinated.
Very
what color is your hair?
I have a pink watch band with a gold face that has Mary and Jesus on it.
And
purple socks.
Okay, good. You have to have good socks. It's important.
Yeah, I buy just the girl socks. They're very silky kind.
Yeah.
They're so much better.
I love socks.
Especially in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right. So I'm going to ask you to complete a couple of stories, because I think I'm just going to call this podcast Storytime with Roger, because you've got good stories.
Okay.
First story. Complete the story. Once upon a time, there was a boy named Roger.
Right. His dad wanted him to be brave. So he took him out to the woods when he was about six or so. He'd already been shooting guns for a while, but he wasn't quite sure that he was brave. So he took him out in the middle of the woods, and then he ditched him and then sort of stalked him to see if he would freak out and get lost, he being me. And I wandered around for a while. I cried a little bit, but I found my way back to Uncle Norman's farm. And that sort of fit into Dad's theory of a scare for fun. Some sort of character was built there. I don't know what kind.
A brave
Probably
one.
The kind of a cruel one who would do that to his child. But, you know, he meant well in his sort of redneck Pennsylvania way.
Yeah, I think my dad threw me in a swimming pool once, and he really meant well.
Yes.
Yeah. I learned a lot that day.
Yeah.
That I couldn't breathe underwater.
Yeah.
All right, next story. Once upon a time, there was a musician named Roger.
Yes, I just found music. It was a thing to find. When I got to be 13, I was just sort of having those urges to get away from my nuclear family, which all 13-year-old boys just sort of naturally have. There was a whole ready-made culture there for me, including outfits and musical instruments and the music you listened to and how you wore your hair and so forth. And I was already used to doing my favorite thing 8 hours a day, baseball. So I would just disappear and do that all day. And it was easy to switch from that to music. It was the same kind of thing. And it was easy. And I got approval pretty fast for it. So I just kept doing it. And it quickly became my thing. So much so that I call myself the record producer or something else.
As opposed to a record producer. You're the record producer.
Yeah. I'm really like a bad sport about other record producers on the planet. I don't quite recognize their right to exist. I'm really sort of competitive and down on a lot of them. And there's a few who inspire me, but they're sufficient age difference that I don't wish them dead actively. Like I do Timbaland. Or Brendan O'Brien. God, what a hack. Or Steve Albini, the worst.
All right, it's David's turn. Go ahead, Davey.
So you play ukulele. What do you find great about that instrument?
Man, the Aloha spirit just sings through it. There's no escaping that. It transforms your mood. The Hawaiians were a very, very refined culture. And when all the different European instruments were presented to them, because there was lots of musical instruments on ships, that's how they entertained themselves. They were very particular about the things they chose and that they liked. And the little Portuguese toy guitar, which is what a ukulele is, they call it the dancing flea. That's what ukulele means. It just fit in with their singing, storytelling culture. It fit in really well with the hula chant, which was the pre-existing form. And they made it their own fast. And I picked it up after the unfortunate jihad incident of 2001. You may have heard of it. And I was just really bummed out. And they were giving away airplane tickets because everyone was scared of this airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I went to San Francisco for $98, I think, round trip in October 2001. And it was like just me and two Sikhs and the crew on the airplane. Nobody was flying. And I got out to San Francisco, and it was such a relief. Everybody was being rude to each other in the streets, and, you know, it was all this stuff. And my cousin, who's a very talented amateur musician, he goes to Hawaii the way we on the East Coast would go to Florida. Mm-hmm. And he had ukuleles around. And I started playing it. It transformed my mood. And then I went to, what's that place in the hippie street? Haight-Ashbury Guitars. Mm-hmm. And I went there and I bought like a $160 ukulele, which I thought would be perfectly adequate. I played it all day in Golden Gate Park and met all these people. And I thought it was great. And then I brought it back to my cousin's house like in the evening. And compared to his Hawaiian-made one, it was just a like a pathetic little plastic toy. And just wasn't going to do so. I went back the next day. I bought the $260 one and played it all day, was perfectly happy with that, and then came back to my cousin's again for dinner, and it was crap compared to the Hawaiian one he had, so I had to go back the next day and buy the Martin ukulele, which I'm not even going to say how much it cost, and that's when I still have that one. That was the beginning of the cornerstone of the ukulele condition for me and the collection, so. And that sort of became part of my identity. I'm the go-to guy for ukulele. And if you were noticing like a huge amount of ukulele on television ads and commercials,
yeah,
that is my influence, I swear to God. And
it has to be.
I have a lot of friends. The very top people in the ad business in New York City are all pals of mine. And I've done television music over the years. And once I started like just bringing out the uke at parties and stuff, and they knew I had it, they'd come over here for sessions. I kept getting calls for that. That's how I ended up on Rufus Wainwright's record and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just started buying it themselves and learning how to play it. And now like, I can't, a single commercial break without hearing the ukulele beach song. You know, it's become the minstrel era of ukulele. Oh, well.
So what other jobs have you had? Like, have you mopped floors or flipped burgers or anything like that?
Oh, no. Music full time for about 24 years. I had some day jobs in high school, and like right after I was fired from Berkeley. So I've worked in a liquor store. I drove deliveries from a pharmacy, a gas station, I guess, a little bit. Mainly, as a teenager, I was always playing in bands with grown ups and playing in cover bands.
Mm-hmm.
My day job really was like, you know, playing Earth, Wind, and Fire and Johnny Be Good and stuff like that, the Royal Order of Moose Lodge, a cover band. And I was like from 13, 14 on. I was doing that 100 days a year. That was a lot of nights.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly cover bands until I went to music school, which was 17.
You mentioned Earth, Wind, and Fire. Do you have a favorite Earth, Wind, and Fire song?
Shining star for you to see what your life can truly be. I just love the production thing at the end of how they, you know, they just took the reverb off at the end. There were just particular songs that I liked, and I always played that kind of funk guitar throughout the 80s once I started my dystopic post-punk band. And I would play, try not to play chords. I'd mainly play sound effects and funk, like two-note guitar parts. Of the ilk of Gang of Four or that sort of thing, sort of scratchy little parts. But I would do legit funk parts, kind of like Chic, like Nile Rodgers kind of guitar. I like that sort of just rhythm guitar, a note or two, or that kind of rhythm guitar where they just play one chord and it's about the right hand in James Brown's band.
So tell us a good concert story.
Oh my God! Well, I'll tell you the concert story of last night.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about that, because I haven't read it yet.
Okay, well, my last night story is, it's McCartney in a little club, 700, capacity venue, and I'm very, very excited, but, I'm kind of worried, because the last time I went to the McCartney show, I got overexcited, and, literally, I was in the 11th row, Madison Square Garden, like, celebrities everywhere. Like Tom Cruise was there. Tons of famous people. But of course, nobody's as famous as McCartney, so they're all trying to just suck a, it's, you know, it's hard for a celebrity at the Oprah level to have someone bigger than to, you know, radiate against. So they're all there. And also, like, soccer moms who can afford the $250 tickets. That's pretty much the crowd sitting around me. And I'm standing with my friend Rob Tannenbaum, who's the music editor at Blender, and an old, old friend, who had kindly brought me. And I was doing okay for, like, the first three songs. And then All My Loving came on. And there was, like, this really fast, rapid pink flashing thing. Have you heard the story about the new logo for the London Olympics?
Oh, yeah, I saw
that.
And it's
causing grand mal seizure,
yes, like,
for people with epilepsy. Instead, they're going to have to redesign it.
Yeah.
I think I might have had a minor epileptic seizure, or I might have had some sort of stroke or something. Like, when these fast pink lights came on, and but I started getting really overexcited. My heartbeat went over like 180 or something, and you know, I was like kind of jumping up and down, and then my heart started really just pounding and racing. My thoughts were racing. Then I felt nauseous. I thought I was going to like wet my pants, and I just had to say excuse me and go out into the in the hallways, and just, I ran around like the entire arena like three times until I tired myself out enough and calmed down enough so I could go to my seat. And you know, I really got literally overexcited.
Wow. Because, you know, you see that happening at shows, and
yeah,
I guess it really happens. Wow.
Yeah. And you know, it's just a, you know, reflection of my predisposition to a certain kind of mental illness that runs in my family. But yeah, it was just very, you know, just way too much. So anyway, I'm driving across the Williamsburg Bridge, and I'm running a little late, and the show's hitting at 8:30 last night, and it's like 8 o'clock, and I'm halfway across the bridge, and I realize I've forgotten my Stevies. And Stevies are this med called Klonopin. It's like Xanax or Valium. And that's what anxious people like me take if they're getting overexcited. Like, I bring them on the scare plane or something for turbulence, or or if I haven't got enough sleep, sometimes I get edgy. Anyway, so I have them, and I forgot to bring the Stevies. And now I'm getting, like, worried, like, oh, shit, I'm going to, like, freak out again at McCartney. It's going to be embarrassing. I can't do that. And so I go there, and there's, like, just fierce security, and I'm looking for good celebrities. I really want to meet Stella McCartney. I don't see her. I see Whoopi Goldberg, you know, big deal. Kira Sedgwick, Kevin Bacon, but nobody's. And it's really for the press, and I see all of the old vampires, like Pirelli's and Chris Gow and David Frick. I mean, God, these guys are all 70 years old, and they're all so hard to please. And McCartney comes out, and the first song is like Drive My Car, and I get excited, I'm jumping up and down, but I don't lose it. So I'm fine, I'm cool, even, but I did reach, you know, my pocket looking for the Stevie, and then I go, damn. Didn't have it, and then it was just fine. I just had a good time, I didn't freak out. So.
That's good, that's a good story.
Yeah.
So who are you working with today?
Right now I'm working with Dina Goodman, G-O-O-D-M-A-N-D-E-E-N-A. Very talented, really nice girl, organized, good at business. We're still just putting down the spine and, you know, tinkering with the form and structure. I have to call a drummer and get a drum over here in an hour, and on we go.
Great.
And then tonight, Holly Awareness is coming over.
Uh-huh.
A very interesting project, because it's like, it's fine art slash scandal slash band. And that's sort of fun. The project's basically, I'm doing six paintings of her, nudes, and we're also doing some photography of the painting sessions.
Uh-huh.
And so the finished product is paintings in an art gallery, and there's a song that goes with each painting. We make it the day of the posing for the painting, and we just collect a whole bunch of drugs, and she takes them all at once, and then performs the song naked, film that a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And then, in terms of her cooperating and or gigging with the act, you know, as a live thing, no cooperation, no gigging.
I love it.
No interviews, no nothing. The product is the 6 paintings, and you also get a CD of the song.
I love it.
And that's it. And I want to sell them for, like, you know, $20K a painting, mm-hmm. and Holly and I split it. And so it becomes as good a payday as getting a song in a movie or something.
That's brilliant. So. I'm going to change the subject here. Why are cats better pets than dogs?
Dogs are whores. They're slut whores. You know, they need you. Like, the cat doesn't care. It comes when it wants and just wants what it wants, and it's more like humans. And it's just also, it's a lot of work. You can't leave your house more than 10 hours.
No, I can leave my cat for like a week, and
sure. She
doesn't care.
That's fine. They don't need you. They don't care.
Sure. Do you talk to your cat?
Yes, I do, in baby talk. It's embarrassing. Yeah.
Does your cat talk back?
She's noisy, hence her name, Chatterbox. You've seen her MySpace page.
I have, yes.
And she's very bossy in the morning and very sort of, and wants to play around 10:30 and let me chase her around or throw bottle caps or corks or little cat treats. And then otherwise it's just asleep all the time, like most cats.
Oh, see, my cat talked to me once, but see, I took some Ambien because I couldn't sleep.
Oh, yeah, I know what this is about, man. I've had that psychotic dream.
I didn't go to sleep.
Yeah,
I stayed awake, and my cat was laying in the bed next
to me. That's a sure sign that you're hallucinating if the cat starts talking.
Yeah, and I wish I could remember what she told me, and I can't, but because it was something really profound.
One of my worst dreams in a hypomanic state, and then I fell asleep and dreamed, was and my cat saying to me, I'm ashamed of you. Dude, it's a human mind. It's just tragic what goes on in there.
All right, who makes for a better backup singer? A blonde, a redhead, or a brunette?
Black girl. Doesn't matter what color hair.
I wanted to ask you, if there's one thing that you can wake up tomorrow and see changed, if there's one thing that you could wish for and see changed tomorrow morning, what would you like that to be?
I mean, it's really easy. The bane of my life is cords and cables, and I'd like all of the cables and wires in my studio to go away, and they're all Bluetooth, and everything just talks to each other. There's no cables, no wires.
Wouldn't that be great? That's going to happen, though, eventually.
It is going to happen.
We're so close. Yeah, wires are dangerous things. All right, two more questions. If you could sit down and have a drink with any three musicians, living or dead, that you haven't already met, who would they be?
John Lennon. Louis Armstrong. Hank Williams.
Yeah, I would pick Hank Williams.
That'd be who?
Are you ready for the grand finale?
Yes.
This is a good one for you. I think you'll be able to do this. Not everybody does this for me when I ask, and so I judge a person's character harshly.
Okay, fine.
If they don't do this for me, will you please give me your best pirate impression?
Give me timbers on a dead man's chest. Yo ho ho and a bottle of rum.
Very good.
Very good. Thank you so much, Roger. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much, guys.